You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where this is the space show. Do you remember back in 2022, there was a spacecraft called Orion, which was going to be launched from the Cape Canaveral, or actually the Kennedy Space Center it was, a mission called Artemis 1. Well, in Yass in New South Wales, there was a guy called Daniel Kelly who was waiting for that launch to happen. And he wrote this song called Back to the Moon. And listen out for a mention of Gene Cernan. Yep, you know who Gene Cernan is, don't you? And the rivalry between the United States and Russia and China. Daniel Kelly, who comes from Yass in New South Wales. And while he was sitting in New South Wales waiting for the Artemis 1 mission, right here in the studio, I've got someone who is actually at the Kennedy Space Center waiting for that very same rocket to launch. His name is Angelo De Grazia. He is a councillor on the Space Association of Australia. Welcome to the Space Show, Angelo.
Well, thanks, Andrew. Thanks to be back again.
And unfortunately, you missed out seeing it go up.
I certainly did. I spent 3 weeks in the United States, two of which was at the Kennedy Space Center, just waiting for the launch. And unfortunately, they tried, but they aborted twice, which meant I was out of time and out of money and had to come back home.
Well, last week, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson and his staff made several announcements about the Artemis 2 and 3 manned missions, and they reviewed the Artemis 1 mission. Let's take a listen to Bill Nelson and what he had to say about that.
We're going to give more time on Artemis 2 and 3. So what I want to tell you is we are adjusting our schedule to target Artemis 2 for September of 2025 and September of 2026 for Artemis 3, which will send humans for the first time to the lunar South Pole. Artemis 4 remains on track for September 2028.
Angelo, what was your reaction when you heard Nelson say that?
I wasn't surprised. There's a couple of factors that I thought would influence the decision. The biggest one, in my view, was the HLS development, the human landing system development. I thought, if anything, that was going to push Artemis 3 out. And in the meantime, some of the problems they were working on Artemis 2 would also cause a little bit of a delay, but certainly not to the extent that was, in fact, announced by Bill Nelson.
One of the reasons that they gave for the delay was some of the problems they had with Artemis 1, the mission you went to see, but...
but missed out.
You saw the spacecraft, but you didn't see it go up.
That's right.
one of them was to do with the heat shield. Let's take a listen to that.
From the test flight in particular, we had two, I would say, one major finding that we need a little bit more time to work, and that is the performance of the thermal protection system on the spacecraft, on the heat shield. We have the heat shield itself and the Orion, the performance specification that we levied on the vehicle and on that system was met with extreme precision. We had a large factor of safety at the bond line of the spacecraft, and the entry guidance performed almost perfectly. We were able to put the vehicle right on top of our partners in the Navy, who were able to recover the vehicle very crisply. But what we did see in the performance of the heat shield itself was some unexpected phenomena that we need to make sure we understand perfectly. The lessons of our history is that even though we believe we understand and that our hardware is performing according to requirements, we have to be absolutely certain that we understand the integrated performance of that system when there are excursions from that performance. What we saw on the heat shield was, again, like I said, very good performance from a thermal protection standpoint. We did see the off-nominal recession of some char that came off the heat shield, which we were not expecting. Now, this heat shield is an ablative material. It is supposed to char, but what we were not expecting were some pieces of that char to be liberated from the vehicle. And so we need to make sure we understand the transport and debris transport phenomena that caused that. We have spent the bulk of 2023 investigating that in facilities across the agency, as well as with help from the DOD. We have an extensive investigation into the root cause of that issue, and it's going very, very well. We have great support from all our industry partners, as well as our partners across the government. We have taken on a methodical, detailed campaign to understand this issue, extensive core sampling, testing, and data review, and all of that review is again, as I said, going quite well. We have to synthesize that data and update the overall thermal, mechanical, and material models of that heat shield to make sure that before we attempt reentry from a circumlunar return mission like we'll have from Artemis 2, that we're 100% confident that we understand the performance of that heat shield under those conditions. We've been able to replicate the physics, and we expect it to definitively identify the root cause of this recession of the char material, hopefully here in the spring.
Now, you must understand that heat shields are very important because the Orion spacecraft, when it returns from the moon, will be slamming into the Earth's atmosphere at 40,000 kilometres per hour. Angelo, how bad do you think the situation is?
Well, it was one of the first issues that was identified after Artemis 1 flight, and so they've had plenty of time to review it. It's looking like they're going to have a solution over the next few months and then implement that in readiness for Artemis 2, which is not until September of 24. So my feeling is they've got this nailed. They know the issue. You've got to remember the heat shield is between 25 millimetres to 75 millimetres thick across the, depending on where it is on the heat shield. They had some uneven wearing of the heat shield, but they've progressed quite well in that, and I think that won't be a problem to them.
But isn't the Orion 2, Artemis 2 spacecraft, already built?
That's funny, because I was thinking the same thing. In fact, they're integrating it as we speak. The service module and the bits and pieces are getting integrated now. So I'm not quite sure just how they're going to do that, but quite clearly, if the view is that they have to add more material or modify it, they will pull the capsule out to do that. But at the moment, there's no word that they're not integrating.
Yes, during the we won't play the audio here, but during the press conference, they were saying that the heat shield lost just a tiny amount. It was just a small amount of the loss, so they could fly. They could decide to fly Artemis II with the existing heat shield.
Correct, and it's the issue is all about margin. Right, it's how much safety factor do you have into these things, and if they do enough analysis and they understand it, they might just allow it to fly. So it might not be a problem, but they understand it, as he was saying in that little review.
Another issue that came up delaying the Artemis II mission was a problem they had with the life support valves. Let's take a listen.
During the acceptance of some components for Artemis III, we noticed a failure in some motor valve circuitry that's driving valves on the spacecraft itself. This is a common motor drive set of circuits that, after investigation, these components passed acceptance testing for Artemis II, but did not pass them for Artemis III, and so that gave us pause to stop and look at that circuit in a more detailed way. When we examined it, we recognized that there was a design flaw in that circuit. Those valve electronics affect many parts of the life support system on the spacecraft, in particular the CO2 scrubbing system. And so once we recognized that the design flaw, and once we looked at rationale for potentially using the system as is, it became very clear to us that it was unacceptable to accept that hardware. And we have to replace it in order to guarantee the safety of the crew. The way to replace that hardware, given the current configuration of the spacecraft, we're going to have to. The access to those bays is going to take us quite a bit of time to get to. Every connector that we touch as part of that replacement operation will have to be tested after we're done, and we'll have to put the vehicle through full up functional testing afterwards. And we're committed to doing that. We know how to fix it. We just need to make sure we take the time to do it according to the workmanship standards that we expect for a human-rated vehicle.
So to be clear, Angelo, this is a problem not with the valves themselves, but with the circuits that control them?
Correct. And my understanding is that there's a lot to do with software as well. They do have to change some of the circuitry, which, as he said, will make it difficult to get to. Again, we commented about the integration of the spacecraft Artemis II as we speak. They may have to delay that because of just this particular reason. They have to access the circuitry. It's not so much the valves. The valves, there's no problem there that has been alluded to. It's just the electronics and the software. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that he mentioned that it was tested and it passed on Artemis II, and the problem identified itself in Artemis III. So did they change the testing regime? And how many other systems have got through without intense testing? It is a concern, this particular one.
Another issue that they raised was the abort system.
For the first time on this spacecraft, we are flying an integrated abort capability. The SLS is a extremely powerful machine, and the Orion is rated to fly in deep space. And when you design a capability for the Orion to actually separate from the spacecraft, from the launch vehicle, in the event of a loss of control, that environment during separation is quite severe. We've qualified the entire Orion to survive during those environments. We have, however, as part of that qualification campaign, found a few cases where we believe there could be some deficiencies in the performance of the electrical system, in particular some of the batteries, that we need to make sure we understand how they're enduring those environments. So we're still very early in that investigation. We've not yet developed a forward path. We have multiple parallel options to fix this issue. We also have a lot of options to determine whether or not we believe those environments are accurate, and we have a lot of testing to do in front of us, but we wanted to make sure we give ourselves the time to do that. And as we mentioned before, continuing our analysis, the crew safety is going to drive our decision-making there on that subject.
Angelo, what is the abort system?
The abort system is essentially a rocket on top of the capsule that in case there's an emergency with the SLS, we'll fire and eject the capsule safely away from a rocket in danger. And it's a tricky little, it's not your Apollo style abort system. It's actually quite a sophisticated little unit. Does a few rolls in the sky and moves the spacecraft away from the rocket. But it is a vital component of the SLS system, of Orion's system in its entirety. In fact, if you recall back some years ago when the Soyuz had a bit of a, was burning at the base of the rocket before launched, their abort system fired and pushed the Soyuz capsule away from the rocket. They were pulling about 12 Gs, I believe, during that fire, but they got out safe and sound.
Not so safe that they were allowed to fly again, those particular astronauts.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. They got a bit, I think they decided that they couldn't fly them again. Check that out, though. All right. Now, one of the things that you saw when you were there was servicing the rocket on the pad was a problem.
It was. In fact, they actually... they had hydrogen leaks. That was the bottom line to the scrubs that I went to watch. They scrubbed because of hydrogen leaks. Now, hydrogen is the smallest element in the universe, and it's pretty hard to get a seal to stop hydrogen leaking. But when it leaks to beyond parameters, then it's a problem. Now, they had to fix that on the pad. And to do that, they sent people there whilst the rocket was fueled, and they had to build scaffolds and do all sorts of things. So it was a real pain in the neck, the ability to service the SLS if you encounter a problem during a launch event. And to the point, Andrew, where those two attempts cancelled the launch for another 2 months.
Well, they've had to think about on-pad servicing, and here's what they had to say.
We want to fly as safely as we can. With the delay, we're going to take advantage of some additional capability and incorporation of lessons learned from Artemis 1, including the ability to potentially access the vehicle at the pad during the launch campaign and during potential weather events.
Our guest here on the Space Show is Angelo De Grazia from the Space Association of Australia, and we'll continue our conversation in a few moments.
88.3 Southern FM.
Here on the Space Show, we are discussing things about the Artemis moon missions and, if we get time, a bit about SpaceX and Starship. Angelo, we've heard that the Artemis 2 mission is going to be delayed. But what actually is the Artemis 2 mission?
Okay, well, Artemis 2 is the first crewed flight of the Space Launch System Orion stack. And it's, I liken it to an Apollo 13 repeat, without the explosion, of course. we're hoping that doesn't happen. But essentially, it's they're on a free return trajectory. In other words, but it's a little bit more complex than that. They have what's called multi-translunar injection. They build up their orbit to the moon, and then once they get into the Earth, into the moon's influence, gravity influence, they then swing by the moon in a free return trajectory and come back to Earth. There'll be four astronauts, three are NASA astronauts, and one is Canadian. And I had the fortune of meeting two of those people when I was at NASA for the aborted first attempt.
Please tell us.
Oh, yeah. Victor Glover, he's the black astronaut there, and he's a terrific guy. But it was hard to get any information of what was going on at the time because all the astronauts spin NASA speak. They won't tell you exactly what's going on. They'll tell you what they are told to tell you. So Victor was a good spin artist, but he was a nice bloke. The Canadian guy, Jeremy Hansen, he's a cool fella, and it's good to see one of our brothers go up on that mission. It's an important mission. The mission specialist will be Christina Cox. She's flown before, and she's well-travelled, as the commander is Reid Wiseman.
For a time, she held the American record for...
She did.
Time and space.
She did. She did. It's a 10-day mission. So Artemis 2 will, for the first time since Apollo 17, actually go to the moon. Then we get to Artemis 3. That's the actual lunar mission. Now, I'm pretty confident with the timeline for Artemis 2, which is September next year. But NASA described the Artemis 3 reschedule as aggressive. Which is code for, I don't think we're going to get that date.
Well, let's take a listen to the choreography that's planned for Artemis 3, and then we can discuss it.
So I'll move on to Artemis 3. For Artemis 3, we're adding several new capabilities. Of course, it's been mentioned by Jim, we're adding a human landing system with a very complex propellant transfer scheme and Earth departure scheme. We're also adding advanced spacesuits. Each one of these spacesuits is an individual spacecraft for the crew. And we're adding a docking system to Orion and new choreography amongst our launch teams for a dual launch campaign required to make sure that both Orion and the lander can get to the same point in space and to proceed with the lunar landing. So the coordination and the choreography of those ground assets, as well as in space and other communication assets, is a significant coordination challenge, and we're doing everything we can to add tests and to add capability to make sure that that's successful. There's extensive integration going on across those systems. Not one of these elements. We have all the transportation elements we've been developing, but with the suits and with the lander, that's a huge conglomeration of different development activities that have to meet together, and not any single one of them is more important than the other. We need them all to be ready and all to be successful in order for that very complicated mission to come together.
It seems to me there's lots of chance for failure. Any one of those links?
No, there's been a few people who have started to raise their hands about the complexity of this mission. It is so complicated. You couldn't have picked a more complex architecture to get to the moon. It requires some incredible technology to do it. For starters, they have to develop a human landing system, and that's SpaceX, and it's based on Starship. It's the biggest risk and probably the pacing factor to that particular first landing on the moon. They then have to fly the actual Artemis, the Orion capsule, to a near rectilinear halo orbit, which is another weird complication. They have to actually get the human landing system into orbit, then refuel it. Now, there's a real debate on how many missions it's going to take of Starship to fly to refuel the rocket. If you listen to Elon Musk, he'll tell you anything from 4 to 8 missions. If you listen to some people at NASA, it could go anything up to 15 Starship flights, I'm serious, to fill up the tanker that will be waiting in orbit to fill up the human landing system so that it can head off to the moon. It is a very, very complicated, complex system.
Well, let's take a listen to what NASA says about these refueling flights.
Bill Harwood from CBS News.
Thank you very much. Can someone address for us how many refueling flights you guys think is going to be required to get HLS from LEO to the moon? You know, there's been everything said from people on the Hill from flights in the teens to just 4. I don't really understand why. I mean, I realize it's variable. I mean, you're in the process of planning all this and the numbers may change. But can someone please ballpark this for us, give us a better idea of just how challenging it is to work all this out? Thanks.
Yes, sure, Bill. It's a great question. I'd like Jessica Jensen from SpaceX to take that. She's been involved heavily in the development. What I would say is, just to start with, SpaceX has been extremely transparent with us, and we've been sharing a lot of data with them about our own challenges in terms of cryogenic refueling. So much of this is just going to have to come from flight tests. And I think probably the reason why you're hearing different numbers is because we have a lot of different modeling and analysis iterations that are going on to do that. But the rubber is going to meet the road when we actually try and do this in orbit. But I'll hand over to Jessica to see if she's got anything else to add.
Yeah, thanks, Amit. One of the things I want to clarify is propellant transfer in orbit. It sounds complex and scary, and it seems like this kind of big nebulous thing. But when you really break it down into the various pieces, we've actually achieved almost all of the complex parts already on our operational programs now. And it's just going to be piecing them together for Starship. So, for example, you know, we've berthed or docked Dragon, the International Space Station, more than 30 times. So everything we've learned from the sensors we use, the algorithms we use for, you know, safe rendezvous, from pulling back, all of that, we're going to leverage all of that in having two Starships docked together. Another big thing that I think can seem very intimidating is, you know, launching missions in close proximity to each other to be able to achieve, you know, rapid refueling. And on Falcon 9, you know, we're able to launch missions within a few hours of each other. Pad turnarounds have gotten very short. We can even launch off the same pad within a few days of each other. So again, we're going to leverage those capabilities that we've learned onto Starship. And then the last bit is, you know, the cryogenic propellant transfer part of it. So again, that is where we're working ground tests right now, and a lot of what we do for cryogenic propellant transfer on the ground, translating that to what we do up in space. And what's so great about this is because we'll be doing it through a flight test perspective, we'll learn on the first flight test, you know, how much propellant is actually transferred versus what we predict. We can make changes then on the ground for the next flight and iterate, and that will actually wind up determining how many missions we need. But even if it's an expensive amount of missions, we have all the capabilities and have already proven them through other vehicles that we will be able to do what Artemis 3 needs.
Jessica, this is Bill Nelson. But the question was, how many fuel transfers?
Hi, Bill. Yes. So I will say it will roughly be 10-ish. That would be my rough guess right now, but it could be lower depending on how well the first flight tests go, or it could be a little bit higher.
she doesn't know.
Look, I commend Bill Nelson for asking the obvious question. Please answer the question. And they know. They know. They just don't want to say, because Elon has come out and said a few numbers, and she's certainly not going to stand there and say or give a contrary opinion to what Elon has said. But the truth is, she's downplaying it. She's saying all our Earth experience will easily adapt to space environment. I find that hard to believe, to be honest. And NASA are rightly concerned about the technical difficulties of refueling in space. And without refueling in space, there is no Artemis 3 mission.
Here's what Elon Musk said at Boca Chica, which you've been to.
Yep.
2 days ago. Here's what he said about this.
So we also want to demonstrate on-orbit refilling. This is very important for the NASA Artemis program. So we're very proud to be part of the NASA Artemis program. I'm always incredibly grateful to NASA for their support and for trusting us to do to take astronauts to orbit, to take cargo to the space station, and to be an integral part of getting astronauts back to the moon.
Well, do we believe Elon and SpaceX, or do we believe the skeptics?
Look, some people accuse me of being a SpaceX fanboy, and sometimes I am. Sometimes I'm very critical of SpaceX, but they certainly have a challenge up for themselves in two areas. The refueling is not going to be as easy as they think it is. The second risk is actually to get Starship to fly and fly reliably, especially if you need 10 to 12 missions to do refueling. And the third thing is they've got to get the human landing system developed. Now, if you listen to the news casts about it, and there's not a lot, you know, things are going well. SpaceX keep meeting their milestones, et cetera, et cetera. But these are really high-risk, high-complex things that may not play out as people expect.
Now, we've been talking about Starship. Here's what Elon Musk had to say 2 days about his Starship.
The Starship is more than twice the thrust of a Saturn V. It is by far the biggest flying object ever made. And for, you know, with some upgrades down the road, it'll actually be, I think, probably over 20 million pounds of thrust. And Saturn V is 7.5. So it'll end up being three times the thrust of Saturn, and it's going to fly a lot. It has to fly a lot. So it's going to end up flying several times a day from many different locations in the world. And I think there's a pretty good chance that it does Earth-to-Earth transport as well, because the fastest way to get from one place to another on Earth is, you know, to get from here to the other side of Earth is an intercontinental ballistic missile, but just make sure you delete the nuke and add the landing part, basically.
Elon Musk, you must admit he has a bit of a sense of humour.
Yeah, wicked one, yes.
Okay, Angelo, more about Starship, please.
Starship, as just to bring everyone up to speed, the first flight of Starship was the 20th of April of 23. So they flew it for the first time, got permission to do it, and they basically wrecked the whole process by flying it prematurely. And it probably did them more harm than good by doing that, because if you can recall, they dug a bit of a crater at the launch pad that flew all the way to South Lab Padre Island, which is some 5 kilometres away. So it didn't do them very good service by doing that. And then it got the FAA ears to prick up, because they've already got issues because people are protesting about it. So they flew IFT or test flight number 2 in November of 23. Lot better. They introduced hot staging and all 33 engines worked on this occasion. So now we're waiting for the third flight, which is estimated to be next month.
Oh, we look forward to that. Now, here's a little clip of Elon Musk's attitude towards firing off lots of things and losing them.
For any given technology development, how many iterations do you have, and what is the amount of time between each iteration? So every time we launch, or do a test, we learn something more. So increasing that cadence of launching and testing, and it's always better to sacrifice hardware rather than sacrifice time. Like, time is the one true currency. So the fastest path to, as I was saying earlier, rapidly reusable, reliable rocket.
Well, Angelo, we've pretty much run out of time here on the Space Show tonight. Any final words?
No, other than 2024 is going to probably be the biggest year in space since the moon landing. So look out for it. It's going to be a great year.
Oh, great. And look, you've got so much more to come to talk about. Can you come back next week and have another chat with us about what's happening with SpaceX and the moon missions?
No problem. Thanks, Andrew.
Well, you have been listening to The Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie for the Space Association of Australia.